We are starting Shar Yichud Ve'amuna on page 287-288. As we've already gone through the introduction, that the purpose of Shar Yichud Ve'amuna, according to what it says in the introduction, is to give us what to think about before davening, so as we arouse a fear and love of Hashem. By understanding these concepts, you'll understand what it takes to have a relationship with Hashem. Mm-hmm. Now, given that, that's good. If a person wants to, that puts it into the level of bina, of understanding. Mm-hmm. But you also have to put it into the level of das. Das means not just I'm going to understand it, and I'll know the ideas, and I'll be able to parrot them back to you. Das means I know what to do with this information. And what Shar Yichud Ve'amuna does is it explains the sensitivity that we are to have in our relationship with Hashem, which there is a dichotomy in our relationship with Hashem. And that dichotomy is explained so that there is no problem. Let's say the idea of yichud. What's the problem? The problem is that if we are to analyze our existence, because what's the problem? Could you put this over there? And we've talked about this before in chapter 20, I think. In an analysis 21, in an analysis of matter, we have the various physics theorem as to what is matter. Okay, and we know, for example, using the basic theory of relativity, which they've disproven now, so I can't really do this stuff anymore because
it's quantum theory.
Things are no longer relative. But the theory of relativity goes E equals MC squared, yes, which energy equals mass times the velocity of its movement.
Speed of light squared.
Yes, okay. So, what does that make mass then? Mass is energy that's not moving. If E equals MC squared, so M equals this E over the square root of C. Right. Okay, which we translate into simple English as a thing not moving. That's mass, or energy not moving, excuse me.
Right.
So, energy is defined as being Hashem. So, the world is really just nothing more than compressed energy. You talked about this in chapter 46. And so therefore, from Hashem's perspective, the only thing that exists is Hashem.
Hashem, correct.
This is alluded to in the verse, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. The word Echad means that there is nothing else besides Hashem. But we believe that everything in the Torah is 100% true. And the best way of proving any concept is by quoting a pasuk. And there is a pasuk that says quite clearly, Breishis bara Elokim eisa shamayim veisa aris. In the beginning, Hashem created the heaven and the earth. Right. That pasuk tells me that the heaven and the earth exist as the word bara, creation, as a separate entity from Hashem. And that is alluded to in Baruch Shem Kivayid Malchus Elohim Vayid, the second bracha, the second pasuk of the Shema, with the key word there being Malchuso. We're going to talk about this in chapter 7. What's the key word Malchuso? Malchus means kingdom. It requires two things to have a kingdom, is a king and a dom. And which is the most important part is the people. And the people can only be a people if they're separate from the king. Because a king is not a king over his own family, nor is a king over ministers. He has to be only a king over those who have a separation from him, that he can have this adnus, this mamshala, this rulership over them. So what we have now is simultaneously in two verses, Shema says we don't exist, Baruch Shem Kivayid says we do. In Zohar jargon, this is referred to as Yehuda Ilah, the supernal unity, and Yehuda Tata, the lower unity. Supernal unity would be easily translated as God's perspective on creation, and Yehuda Tata would be our perspective on creation. And the thing is that the wonderful thing about Judaism is we can say that only God exists and we exist too, and there is no contradiction. And we'll understand that when we get done with all 12 chapters of Shaar Yichud V'Amunah. And if you're going to put that into Das, then you will see how is our relationship with Hashem. That should be our goal. Your homework, your mission, should you choose to accept it, which you have no choice actually to accept it, you have to do it. So the first six chapters of Shaar Yichud V'Amunah explain how the creation from Hashem's perspective. Okay. Chapters 7 through 9 explain our perspective on creation, and 10, 11, 12 explain how they fit together. Okay?
Okay.
So we start, Lahavin Ma'at, above where it says Perek Aleph, in the little letters. Lahavin Ma'at Mezer Mashakazah Bizar. This Shaar Yichud V'Amunah is going to allow us to understand just a little bit that which is written in the Zohar. The Shema Yisrael Chulu Hu Yehudi Ilah. That the first pasuk of the Shema is Hashem's perspective on creation, the upper unity. And the second pasuk of the Shema, the Baruch Shem, is our perspective on creation, known as the lower unity. So yes, it is normal with every discourse in Chassidus, is we'll start with a pasuk. And we'll ask a couple of questions about the pasuk. And then we'll go off on a tangent.
Yes.
Okay. There is, in this instance, though, unless I'm forgetting something, I don't believe he comes back and answers the questions clearly, but you kind of get the idea what the answer is. I think maybe in chapter 3 kind of sort of does, but anyway. So he says, V'yedaita hayayim v'ashivaz olavacha ki Hashem hu alakim v'ashamayim imal v'aris v'itachas ein oid. That you should know this day and you should put it in your heart, that in the heavens above and in the earth below, there is no other. And this is where is this pasuk from? I know it's, my brain is not working. Whatever. So this is a pasuk from the beginning of Devarim. You should know this day, you should put it in the heavens above and in the earth below, there is no other. Okay? Moshe was saying this to the Jewish people in the book of Devarim, which the book of Devarim's main theme is, if you take care of Hashem, Hashem will take care of you. And there are a couple of key words to focus on over here. It says, V'yedaita, it doesn't say la'aviyavin, it doesn't say you should understand, it says you should know. Okay? Hayayim means every single day. It has to be, the idea is kachadashim. It says every single day, the Torah has to be a new thing in your eyes. Such that when someone gives you a new thing, what do? You get all excited about it. Yeah, I got this new thing. I'm all excited.
It's not the same as what it is.
And a couple of years go by and it's sitting on the shelf and no one's ever looked at it. No. Yeah. The Torah has to be new every single day. Okay? Yeah. This relationship we have. And then you have to put it to your heart. And that's what he's going to put in question is that in the heavens above there's, well, there's no other. Okay. V'tzara lahavi. Kitala daitach shiyesh alakim nashara b'mayim itachal za'ar shetzorech lachzik kol kach v'ashivaz alavavecha. Would you ever think there's another God hiding someplace underneath the water? That you'd have to say, v'yadaita hayam, put it to your heart, v'ashivaz, and put, and put it to your heart, is there no other God?
That makes no sense. The latter part makes no sense after 4 years.
That's the question. First you have to understand the question. We're not asking you to understand the answer.
Right.
Why does the pasuk go to such stringencies, a strictness and expression, to say something which is obvious? A famous story with Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Berdych when he was first married. Remember the story? He was already a member of the Hasidic movement. At that time, the word Hasidism had not been adopted, and they were simply known as the Kat, the sect.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a member, clandestine, people kept it shashtil. His father-in-law was a virile anti-chassid type person.
Mm-hmm.
Just would not have anything to do with it. Okay, they had all kinds of conditions of the tanoim about what he's going to do with himself. He's going to learn for a certain amount of time. He's going to take care of them. So he came in and he's supposed to be learning. So he comes at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there's a maestro like this, and he sees that his son is davening. Okay, son-in-law. So he says, I thought you're supposed to deal as a daven with a minyan. And he says, I'm davening with a minyan. I'm davening with my eser kreichos and nefesh. I'm davening with my ten powers of my soul. So the father-in-law didn't want to hear this. He just didn't want to hear it. So he told him, listen, I had enough of this. You have to divorce your wife and get out of my house. That's all. You know, just get out. I don't want to know from you anymore with you or your nonsense. And he refused, and he went to the daughter and said, this guy's a member of this wild group, and who knows what's going to be, and you have to divorce him. And she said, my husband's a tzaddik. I am not going to divorce him. Okay, so what happened is the pressure got really heavy, and he took off. He didn't tell anybody where he's going, and he's gone. I mean, like, gone. And he said, see, look what I told you. Now you're in a guna. Mm-hmm. You're not just, nope, I'm full confidence in my husband. 3 years go by, not a word. Which I kind of have suspect that why couldn't he write a letter to his wife, let him know where he is. But, you know. 3 years go by and he shows up. So, nope, by this time the father-in-law had cooled off a little bit. He's just like glad that the guy came back, I guess. I mean, if it would have been me, I might have punched the guy right, punched my son-in-law right out for doing such a thing. Uh-huh. So, any future son-in-law listening on the RabbiFinman.com, you heard me say it.
Yes.
So,
be advised.
Be advised.
Be advised.
Forewarned is forearmed. So he asked his son-in-law, so no, where were you? So he said, I was in Mizrich with my rabbi. I says, and what did you learn there? He said, I learned that there's one Hashem. So he says, you spent 3 years in Mizrich learning that there's one Hashem. He called over, there was like a cleaning girl, I don't know, she was like 14 years old, was cleaning this guy's house. And he says to her, excuse me, could you answer this one question for you, one for us? And he says, yeah. He says, how many Hashems are there? And she kind of looked very quizzically at them and said, one? And she's, you know, like, huh?
What's the question?
What's you know, like, why, you know, like,
this
huh?
Is when women weren't taught.
Yeah, well, no, what's, it's, so
what's
that's
the
what
question?
He said. Yeah. What's the question?
Yeah, what's the question?
You know, like, there's no possible other answer. It's like, that's it. It's not even duh. It's less, even less than duh.
Exactly. Why are you asking it?
Yeah, why? Why the question? So she said, thank you very much. She says, see, she's a 14-year-old girl. She's never been educated. And she knows there's one Hashem. So he says, no. She says it. I know it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what's the big tadadam that you have to put, when it says, Ahashe v'isa elo avavecha, commit it to your heart. That doesn't mean memorize it. Mm-hmm. There's a famous story involving Moshe Feller, the shliach in Minnesota. Okay, he does not have a large family. They had problems having kids. And Mendy came along after some while, and when Mendy was like 3 years old or something like that, they went into Yechidus, and it was before Pesach. And the Rebbe asked, did you learn the Manishtana Baal Peh? And the kid said, yeah. Okay? So he gave him like an extra dollar or something like that, or gave him a nickel, whatever he gave him. The next year they came back, and this year the Rebbe asked, the kid, did you, he's now 4 years old or 5 years old, did you learn the Manishta by heart? And the kid said, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, afterwards, he gave him again, he gave him another nickel. So afterwards, a letter came out from the Rebbe, the Moshe Feller. It says, I specifically didn't ask the same question last year to this year. Last year I asked him, did you learn it Baal Peh, which means by your mouth. Right. This year I asked, did you learn it by heart?
Right.
Which means that from last year to this year, even in a small child asking the Banishtana, there has to be a noticeable improvement in the feeling that the person says it for.
Right. Yes.
Okay? Because in the last years of the Rebbe's life, who said the Banishtana at the Seder? The Rebbe.
Was he?
Oh. He did it by himself. He did his own Seder by himself.
I thought his secretary.
His secretary was a Masharish, but he was not participant in the Seder. He brought in the stuff that he needed. Okay, but the Rebbe did his thing over there. Okay. So he asked the question, Manishtana. Mm-hmm. And he happened to give the answer, too. Okay. So the question therefore lies is, what's the big ta-da-dum? Why would you, Moshe have to say that you really got to commit yourself to this one God concept? Now, you could say, in looking at the his clientele, what happened 14 years after Moshe died? They started worshiping idols.
Mm. That long ago. That Micha before that.
Yeah, 14 years. That's all it took.
Yeah.
Okay? So, you could say he knew his customers. You say, listen, you really got to focus on this. You have to say the Shema every day. You have to make this proclamation. You're going to really have to believe it. And even though you're going to want to put your head in, on the front of the on the ground in front of this stone statue, you shouldn't do that. And you should know, and you should really commit yourself to this, the monotheism thing. Okay? You could look at it that way. The Torah is eternal. Hashem knew in giving Moshe the Torah that with the destruction of the first temple, the taiva for idolatry, which we don't understand, would be taken away from us.
Hmm.
Why was idolatry so prevalent among Jews during the first temple time? Is because we had this desire which was satiated by putting our head down on the ground in front of a stone, which now we don't understand it.
Right.
But there was such a lust for it that was only eased and quenched when a person engaged in idolatry.
Hmm.
Okay, and with the destruction of the first temple, Hashem said, they can't handle it anymore, I'm taking it away. Okay, but they'll have sex instead.
It's a great prophecy.
Yeah. So you could say that's what Moshe was talking about, but the Torah, God knew when he gave the Torah that eventually he's going to take away the whole thing and that this whole business about idolatry is no longer be appropriate. We don't have to be told, you know, don't worship idols like they did 2,000, you know, 3,000 years ago. Because we're not interested. So the question of the Alter Rebbe is, what do we have to worry about so much? Okay? So he makes it. He's going to answer this with a pasuk. La'elam Hashem dvarach anisa b'shamayim. A pasuk in Tillim that reads, "Forever Hashem, your word stands firmly in the heaven." Upir shabal Shem Tov zal, and he quotes the Baal Shem Tov in his commentary, which is interesting. That there's always something that could be learned when he gives a footnote within the body of the text.
Mm-hmm.
That which he's about to quote does appear in the writings of the Baal Shem Tov, right? I don't remember if it's Kesar Shem Tov or Tzivos or Rivash, but it's definitely there. But it just so happens that it's in Medrash Tillim. Medrash Tillim was written long before the Baal Shem Tov. So if he's going to quote a source, why quote the Baal Shem Tov quoting Medrash Tillim? Quote Medrash Tillim. Okay? The answer is that the Alter Rebbe, who initially thought that this was going to be the first page of the book, wanted to convey I guess you call it a Hakara Satov, or a recognition of what the Baal Shem Tov was able to accomplish right at the onset.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because the Baal Shem Tov, the ramifications, the Shar Yechid V'Amunah, is Hashgacha Pratis. Mm-hmm. And he says this quite clearly in chapter 2.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
In chapter 2 and chapter 7 are devoted pretty much to Hashgacha Pratis. And it's the Baal Shem Tov's definition of Hashgacha Pratis that he wants to bring out.
Mm-hmm.
Did people believe in Hashgacha Pratis before the Baal Shem Tov? They did, but it had a whole different connotation.
Different quality.
You had people who believed, or who purported, whatever, that Hashgacha Pratis involved only Jews and didn't involve non-Jews.
Wow.
You have Hashgacha Pratis that it involved people but not animals and lower organisms. You have people, you have theories that it involved hashgacha of the species, but not specific organisms within the species.
Mm-hmm.
Like the deal on Rosh Hashanah was going to be, there's going to be, say, 20 million cows this year.
Right. Okay.
But not specifying which cows are going to be the ones that are going to be the 23 million. that was going to be left up to its own devices.
Yeah,
no. Comes along the Baal Shem Tov and says, none of that stuff makes any sense.
Yeah,
if you're going to have 23 million cows and some are going to have to die, well, how would determining which ones die could only make sense if there is divine providence which is pushing this one.
Exactly.
Okay, and if you're going to say that there's Hashgacha Prat is only among Jews, okay, so then all your interactions with your non-Jewish contemporaries,
right,
that they have no Hashgacha Pratis. So how does it? It doesn't. I can't even put the paradigm together.
Yeah, it doesn't.
What would you pray for?
This guy has Hashgacha Pratis, and this guy has no Hashgacha Pratis. It's left up to just happenstance.
Chance, yeah.
Yeah. So which really, you know, so it's Hashgacha Pratis that this Jew should be talking to this non-Jew, but it's happenstance that the non-Jew should be talking to the Jew.
Yeah.
So you have problems with these theories.
Sure.
Comes along to Baal Shem Tov and says, Hashgacha Pratis is exactly what it means. Every single organism is controlled specifically by Hashem. And he's going to now say why that is. That's why he quotes the Baal Shem Tov instead of Midrash Tilim. He says, Ki dvarach ha-sha'amri yehi rakia b'teich ha-moyim. You have, for example, you have the 10 utterances.
Hmm.
Those are the words of Hashem. And the words, Yehi Rakia, let there be space, in the water, the higher water, the lower water. The Tevis, Isis, Elahain, Nitzavis, Va'imdis, La'ilam, Betecha, Rakia, Shamayim, that these letters of these words are always standing and planted forever within the firmament. Umalushim, Betech, Kola, Rakia, which is enclosed in all of these different levels of heaven, of space. La'olam la'hachayosim, forever to enliven them. Kedeksiv, as it's written, or like it's written, Dvar Elokeinu Yakim la'olam u'dvar chayim l'kayam la'ad. As it says, the word of our God stands forever, and the living words exist for eternity. What that's saying, when it says la'olam dvar chanitzav ha'shamayim, that the creative force of let there be a firmament, let there be space, has to be ongoing.
Yeah.
So it's not that Hashem created the world 5,772, almost 73 years ago,
mm-hmm,
and then let it go.
Yeah.
And he discusses those two different philosophies that discuss that. In chapter 2, he discusses Aristotle.
Right.
I was gonna say that.
And in chapter 7, in the middle, he discusses the Vilna Gaon.
More Nebuchadnezzar talks about that.
Yeah, it's brought down to Morin Nebuchadnezzar like that. But the it's talking about that, but the Morin Nebuchadnezzar negates it also.
Right.
So the Goyim don't. Christian philosophy is based on Aristotelian philosophy.
Yeah.
So the so this godliness has to be involved in creating the world constantly. What is it, and how does this? What does it mean? The words. It says words are made out as a composite of sounds, which in writing are represented by letters.
Mm.
Sefer Yetzirah, which is a book written by Avram Avinu,
yeah,
in discussing how to go about making a creation, discusses this concept of letters.
Right.
That the letters, he calls them bricks. And he says, from two bricks you get two words, and from three bricks you get, or he calls them houses. From two bricks you get two houses, from three bricks you get six houses, from four bricks you get, 16 houses. From five bricks you get 25 houses. From five you get 125.
125, that's right.
From four you get 24, and from five you get 125, and from six you get 540, whatever, and seven you get 50, 40. And then after that he says, go figure it out what you get from the rest of them.
Yes.
Okay. He calls the letters bricks.
Yes.
Bricks are an inanimate object.
Right.
Which in and of themselves, if you just look at a pile of bricks before they've been formed into anything, it's just a pile of bricks. But when they're stacked in a specific order, so now it looks like a house.
Right.
So the letters, each letter by itself, there is no one letter word in Hebrew.
Right.
You need to have two letters specifically. Each letter by itself is, for all intents and purposes, an inanimate object. It doesn't convey anything. There's no life to it. But what is it? It's a channel.
Right.
For which the godliness to come down. And it is possible to determine what kind of godliness we're talking about, how the godliness is coming down, even with the very shape of the letter.
Yeah.
There's this great discussions about the various shapes, why they look the way they look. A yud is a point, representing the quintessential point of Hashem, which starts with yud kei vav kei, and also the quintessential point of a Jew, which starts with also a yud Yehudi. Or if you like the word yid, there's the same word like yud, but that's Yiddish. Okay? So that's a yud, it's just a point. And an aleph is a point on the top and a point on the bottom and a connector between the two. To indicate a connection between Hashem on the top and the Jews on the bottom and a connector, which is Yerushimayim, in between them. And this is true with all of the 26 letters of the alphabet, that each letter shape conveys a certain specific godliness to come down into this world.
Yeah.
And he's going to talk about here about a little bit about, he talks about gematria, and you can compare that the hamshacha of a tuf is going to be comparable of a shin and a kuf.
Mm-hmm.
Because they both have a numerical of 400, even though they don't look the same, but there's going to be points of comparability in them. And this is how the creation process is you have all these different various combinations and permutations and letters switch. Mm-hmm. You have different alphabets. You have Atbash, where the Aleph becomes a Tuf, and a Tuf becomes an Aleph, and a Beis becomes a Shin, and a Shin becomes a Beis, and a Gimel becomes a Resh, and a Resh becomes a Kuf, it's Atbash, Gardak, etc. Okay, until you get to a mem becomes a samach and a nun stays the same.
Okay.
So the I believe
samach could make sense.
Yeah. So those letters change, and then you have something called misperkutin, which misperkutin means is that it's not just enough to have the numerical values the same. If you chop off the zeros. Okay, so there's a relationship between a tav and a mem and a dalet. Because you chop off all the zeros, you get 4 for all of them. And since you're doing that already, so then we have an alphabet called Atbach, where an aleph changes for a tes, and a base changes for a chaf. No, a ches, excuse me. And you do all kinds of things like this. And all of these, what they are, is what they're indicating is, if you find a word, this word in Atbach, which that takes 2 steps. The first you have to diminuate the letters, chop off of the zeros. And then you have to transverse it from the beginning to the end to the beginning. So there's like 2 different steps there. Every step that is done in this type of a process indicates a greater obfuscation of godliness. The godliness becomes more hidden with every step in the creation, which is why we've been saying all along that the creation process is such that the godliness no longer even resembles godliness anymore. To such an extent that a person could say, in this physical world, there's no such thing as God. That's how much the godliness has gone through to get here.
Yeah.
You don't have angels saying, they're saying, Aye Mekayim Kevoide, where is Hashem's glory? Why are they saying that? Is it because they don't see Hashem? No. With the Malachim, they see Hashem, but they know there's more. That's what it is. They're not saying, Aye Hashem. They're not saying, where's Hashem? Hashem's right here in front of me. They're saying, Aye Mekayim Kevoide, where's the place of His glory? Where's the real revelation of Hashem? Not this, just this little chump change godliness. I, angel, number one, am getting.
Chump change.
Okay? So, the letters, so what is it that's forming the rikia are the letters resh, kuf, yud, and aleph. Each letter is conveying godliness in a different way. Resh Kuf Yud Ayin, excuse me. In a different way, I don't know why, it just popped into my head this example, but do you remember the Play-Doh Fun Factory when you were a kid?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kids have it.
You have this like die, okay? So you put the Play-Doh in, and if it's got like say a letter A, die over it, you cut up, and out comes the letter A. I don't know why that popped into my head because that's not what we're talking about at all. But it's a really bad example, okay? But that's what's happening is the Godliness is coming down. The Godliness is coming down in a pristine state. And we've been talking all along that that godliness maintains its integrity.
Right.
Even as it goes through the creation process.
Right.
So that finally it comes up to the word rakia, the godliness is still the same, but now it's manifest as a firmament.
Mm.
What's changed? How you see it. Okay, an example with the Play-Doh. So the Play-Doh is still Play-Doh.
Right.
But now it looks like an A or a B, whatever.
Right, yes.
Okay, but the integrity is still there. And the point that he wants to make is it has to be a constant, ongoing thing. And I'll give an example soon, which he doesn't give, but it's a classic Hasidic example, and I believe the Alter Rebbe, one of the Maimarim, actually brings in this example to explain it. If it would be that the letters of speech, if God would suddenly shut up and stop talking, what would happen? He stopped saying the 10 utterances.
Everything would stop.
Kerega for a moment. Chas v'sholem. The Alter Rebbe, we said before, very, very smart about using the chas v'sholem. Yes. Hashem did not say, let there be light. 5,773 years ago, Hashem is saying now,
yes.
Let there be light.
Yes. Yes.
The creation is going on now, and he says, why does that have to be?
So it's not just willing it, it's a speech as an action.
Yeah, he's bringing it into existence. Yeah. Hashem has to be constantly creating the world, keeping it in existence, yes.
Wow.
It would be that the heaven would go back to absolute null and void, and it would be that it never existed before. So someone once told me when it says ayin ve'ef is mamish, so it refers to, which means just ayin is nothing, and ef is more nothing, and mamish just means absolutely. Okay. So it's three different levels of nothing. It's Bria, Yetzira, and Asiya. By the time you get down to here, it's mamish nothing.
It's mamish nothing, isn't it? Yeah. V'haya
kalohaya zo, they never existed.
K'may kaita
maimi yehira kiya mamish. As it was with everything. We give an example. Classic Hasid example at this point is with a rock.
Mm.
What do rocks do?
Exist.
Yeah, they just kind of sit there.
They don't move.
Like a rock. They just kind of sit there like this, inanimate object, okay? How long will a rock sit there?
Yes.
Okay, it'll sit there until someone picks it up and moves it.
Someone exerted some other force upon it.
Okay,
right.
So now, we discussed
only
this actually.
Until then.
So this we actually discussed
and
this
And when they
21.
Stop, it stops.
Right. Only we discussed it in chapter 21. We just talked about it in brief.
Mm.
So what happens now? Somebody comes and picks the rock up and throws it.
Right.
So what happens now to the rock?
It slows down, stops, and
it's falls. It's flying in the air.
Right.
And then what happens is eventually when the energy which is used in to get the rock to overcome the forces which are keeping it on the ground.
Right.
So it'll stay up for that amount of time and then it'll fall back down to earth.
Mm.
Is it possible to throw a rock up in the air and have it stay up there for 500 years?
Sure, I guess.
Yeah, you call it a satellite.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a satellite.
It's a stone.
It's a piece of metal, which is
iron, iron ore.
And with the little battery thing counted, it's pushing it. That's all it is.
That's it. Right.
Okay, and what happens? I don't want to be around in 500 years when all that junk starts falling out of the sky.
You know.
Wait.
Or let's just say, I don't want to be underneath when that,
most of it will burn up in the atmosphere.
Probably. Anyway, so the rock when it's up in the air, would we say that it is a flying rock? Or would we say that it is a rock that's still sitting, but it's sitting on a force which is propelling it?
Sitting on a force.
What, why would I ask this question?
Yeah.
Let's say you were raised in a cave.
Yeah.
And one day you decide to walk outside of the cave.
Yes.
And the first thing you see when you're outside of the cave is that somebody has, it goes whizzing past your face like this. Someone had thrown a rock.
Yes.
And you see this thing flying. And so now, according to your perspective, what you just saw is a flying rock?
Yes, rocks can fly, yes.
Rocks can fly. I just saw it.
Yes.
Okay. Is that an incorrect statement? It depends on which opinion you're asking.
According to where you're looking, yes, exactly.
From which perspective are you looking?
Yes.
If you're looking...
through the keyhole.
If you're looking from Hashem's perspective, so the rock is sitting, and the rock is still sitting,
right.
And you're introducing a force, and the rock is still sitting, except not sitting on the ground, it's sitting on a force.
Right. Exactly.
So from Hashem's perspective, well, let's, before I have to give the example, then there's the other way of looking at it,
right.
is that the energy is enclosed within the rock, changing the nature of the rock to be a rock which sits to a rock that flies. That's the other way of looking at it. You've instilled energy into the rock, changing its nature. And for as long as that energy is there, the nature of this rock will be to fly. I'm not asking you if that's what you think. I'm telling you that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Okay, you have this,
it's like the kinetic
and potential energy,
I hear.
And its effect on an immovable object, okay? That's what's going on over here.
Okay.
Let's ask a question. What was here before the world was created?
Hashem.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Nothing was here, okay? What does nothing do?
Nothing.
There is no do.
Nothing does nothing.
Right.
How long will nothing do nothing for?
There's nothing to do.
As long as it does nothing.
As long as it's nothing, that's correct. What happens if we put some energy into the nothing and we turn it into a something? How long will this nothing be a something?
As long as the energy is there.
Correct. What happens when the energy dissipates or is used up?
It's nothing.
It remains
the something goes back to being a nothing.
Right.
As though it never was before.
It always was nothing.
That's now the question. Is the nothing, when it's now got this energy in it, is it now a something? Or does it remain a nothing sitting on a force making it look like it's a something? And the answer is yes.
Exactly.
From Hashem's perspective, it's a nothing that's sitting on a force, making it look like a something.
Correct.
From our perspective,
it's a something.
Right.
Because we can't see it, right?
From our perspective, we're not making a mistake.
Right. Correct.
We have a pasuk that says it exists.
Right. We
see the world as a something. It's absolutely 100% true.
We have
none of this row, row, row your boat stuff.
It's not though.
The fact is, we have a perspective.
It's a valid perspective. Right. It's a Torah perspective.
Yeah, we have a perspective. Yeah.
Okay. So which is correct? They're both correct.
You're
talking about from Hashem's perspective. You're talking about our perspective.
Yes,
I see.
Okay? And it's not that we have this where we're like in a virtual reality. There's no mothership up there where they pull plugs on people.
Good deal.
Great movie, though.
Okay? There is just as I never saw it. I just know they ever brought it.
I have all three DVDs.
Okay. So, we're not living in a virtual reality. This is reality. You want to get into, what is reality then? You know, the reality that a schizophrenic is experiencing, is it reality? Well, for him it is. I heard a story. There was a guy in California, calls 911, okay? And he tells them that someone has to come and get his parents because they're not believing his hallucinations are real. He sees them.
Right.
But he's calling them his hallucinations.
Right, right.
But they're absolutely 100% real.
Yes.
So the dispatcher recognized that this person was obviously on some sort of intoxicant.
Yes.
And said, I'm going to hang up the phone now. If you call back, I will send a car over there and I will arrest you for there's a crime for misuse of 911. You can't crank call 911.
Right, right.
They're not therapists. No,
yeah. Yeah, you can't crank call them. Okay, you can't, like, you know, hang up 911 and die. Click hello, you know, hello 911. Is your refrigerator running? Yeah, you better catch it.
Uh-huh.
No, we're not. They don't take kindly to that type of stuff, and you could go to jail.
You get to deliver the refrigerator.
That's correct. Okay, so they came and they arrested the guy.
Yeah, of course. Okay, yes, of course they did.
Making license plates.
Yeah, so. But he wants people to. Yeah, I want you to understand my reality. Mm. Which is why it says in Perkei Avos that when somebody does something and it's really peculiar, you can't really say anything about it until you put yourself in that person's perspective.
Right.
If you now put yourself into that person's perspective and you come up with a conclusion, this guy's nuts, then the guy's nuts. But until then,
you can't
it's an amazing thing. The world's great inventors were borderline clinical.
All of them nuts, yes.
To be an inventor, first of all, you have to be OCD.
Yeah.
That goes without saying.
Of course.
But then to be an inventor, you got to ask, you ask me, what does the world need? Yeah. I'd say, I don't know, everything seems fine to me.
Toaster, yeah.
We got everything already.
Yeah.
And was it 1904? I think that there was a bill to close the patent office.
Yes, because
everybody that could possibly need to be invented
has already
been invented. And how many patents were there? I think there was something like 20,000 patents.
Right, yeah.
Okay, and that was it.
Yeah.
Okay, they did not close the patent office. They get more than 20,000 patent requests a day in this country.
Yeah.
Okay, so what has to happen is, to the average person, what does the world need? We got everything. You know, they have these columns for the man who has everything. And they have this stuff over there. It was absolute, you know, it's the Sky Mall magazine. It's like, huh?
What?
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
Electric.
I've never walked into anybody's house. Not even some of the wealthier people with whom I learned that have said, look what I got from the Sky Mall magazine.
Really?
Nobody, I don't think anybody buys anything from that magazine.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't say that because they've been putting them out
for years and apparently
decades.
They're making money, yeah.
Somebody's doing something over there. So it's not just for our entertainment. I think, what kind of weird thing could they possibly come up with next?
Your Mink Life Vest.
Yeah, the little vacuum, portable battery vacuum cleaner with a tube on it for sucking flies off the wall. Yeah,
right,
that's what I'm saying. The doggy foot washer. Yeah. I mean, you know, all these things that they have.
Personal bug zapper.
They've had these things for decades in the same place, right, in the same magazine. Okay, so the person who's an inventor is thinking, they think out of the box. They look at the world in a different perspective.
Right.
For them, it's a different reality.
Yeah.
I see this, and I can make of this.
Right.
I learned with a guy who is a professional inventor.
Yeah.
He's got like 30 patents for all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay? And he doesn't think like what you would call a normal person. He just doesn't.
Yeah.
His logic progressions, like we think A, B, C, D, E, in a logical sequence like this, and that's called normal.
Yeah.
He is all over the place. He's going A, N, J, P, Q, 1, 2, 3, and beyond.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Okay? And if you didn't know better, you would say, this guy's totally off the wall. Yeah. What is he talking about? Why would you even think about doing such a thing? But listen, he's got 30 patents. Okay, and he makes a very nice living from his patented products. Yes. And none of them appear on the Home Shopping Channel.
Yeah.
So, they're all industrial, you know. Yeah, so.
Never watched it.
They don't have the industrial shop, the industrial shopping channel.
The inventor's greatest curse is the Home Shopping Channel.
Yeah, really. Okay, so.
Yeah, that's not good.
So our perspective on creation is that we do exist, and it's 100% true. If you cut me, will I not bleed? If I smash my hand against the table, is it going to go through it?
No.
Science will tell you that this table is comprised mostly of space.
Nothing.
Okay, because the distance between the nucleus and the electron is this huge space.
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of these things. So why can't I kind of like switch my electrons to go through that? Go through the electrons of the table. Since there's so much space, yeah, just go right through. Okay, everybody remembers that. I'm quoting too many comic books over here. That episode of Superman, where he kind of like thinks himself through the concrete walls.
Mm-hmm. It's the one of the four forces. The weak force is what keeps our hands.
Yeah. Open. Okay. So we believe there's a lot of space in between, but our hand's not going through. But we still believe there's a lot of space.
We know it.
You know that there's a lot of space between your atoms.
Yes.
How? No one's ever seen it. Yeah, you learned
it. They have. You read
it a book. No one's ever seen it. They don't have microscopes big enough to see nuclei, and for sure not electrons.
Empirical, seen it.
Yeah. They kind of figured it. That must be this way.
Masses and
from the clouds that are left behind, they come out that this must be the way it is.
Correct. It's incredible.
But they haven't
If a proton was a beach ball for hydrogen, the electron would be in China.
Right. Exactly.
The size of a period on a page.
Right.
It's incredible how much. And it's the weak force that ties them together.
Right.
Weak. That's okay. The funny part.
So, the... Vafilu Eretz HaTzalazu HaGashmius V'chines Daimei Mamish, that even this physical world, which is comprised of inanimate objects, Ilu HaYemes HaLekes M'mena K'rega Chasa Sholom HaOisiyis Masarim HaMarish Shebehem Nivru HaOrez V'shashimei Breshit, if it would be that the letters would leap from the rock, even from one moment, what would happen is that the rock would cease to exist like it was before the creation. And it would go back to as though it had never existed before. Because you take a look, you take the rock, you throw it in the air, and it lands on the ground. 5 minutes later, is anybody going to be walking by and notice, hey, that rock was once flying? That one that's sitting on the ground over there, that used to be a flying rock.
Resident energy.
Can you take it one level further? That all evidence that rock goes away, so if the rock threw a rock at the wall and made a dent, then you took the letter away and the dent goes too?
No, it wouldn't. No.
The effect of the rock.
The effect of the rock is still there.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Okay. So
now, at this point,
you understand that
you have to bring in this idea of, well, where does rocks come from? He said he brought before the example Rakia, because it says Vayomer Elokim Yehi Rakia. There has to be a firmament. There has to be space where to put stuff. Okay. But we're talking about rocks.
Okay.
I'll give you $10 every time it says God says let there be rocks in the Torah.
Good deal.
Okay.
I'm gonna go hungry.
Yeah, exactly. So, but do rocks exist?
Of course they do.
Of course they do. So, if it doesn't say in the Torah, God said, "Let there be rocks," how could there be rocks? It says, it doesn't say anything about rocks in the Torah. So, what it says is, let me get a pencil and paper. Just a second. Okay, it doesn't say rock, but what it does is it says Yabasha. You know, whatever it says over there. The third day, God said, let the dry land appear from the water.
Right.
Okay? So the word Yabasha is spelled Yud, Beis, Shin, Hey. That's the word Yabasha. Okay? You can see all this. Okay? For you people listening at home on the internet, well, I've written a Yud, a Beis, a Shin, and a Hey. The word for rock is Evan, which is an olive. a base, and a final nun. Okay, so what we want is, we want to see how is it that rocks are contained in the dry land? Because what is dry land comprised of? It's comprised of lots of stuff, and one of the things that happens to be there are rocks. So if rocks are in dry land, so rocks have to be, the word Evan has to be in Yabasha.
Correct.
Okay, so we have a base. The second letter of both words is a base. So that was an easy one.
Yes.
Okay, we're a third the way there. Okay, the third letter is a shin. You ever play Scrabble?
Yeah.
Okay, you hate it when the person puts down the letter Z-E-E
yeah.
with a Z on a triple letter score, for
yeah.
example.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's Z, Z-E-E? It's the way you spell out the word for the letter Z.
Z, right.
Exactly. Yeah, so you do this, you take a shin. When you're saying the word shin, you are saying a shin, a yud, and a final nun. Okay, the last letter of the word shin, which is in the word yabasha, is a final nun. And so there we have, are hidden within the word yabasha, the final nun of the word evan.
Right.
If we do the same thing, this yabasha and evan is very easy. If we do the same thing with the hey, and we spell the hey aleph, so the last letter of the word hey is an aleph, and that then relates to the first letter of our word evan. So what do we have to do in order to get evan out of dry land, rock out of dry land? There had to be a permutation of the godliness, such an extrapolation. It was always there,
right.
but it didn't come out into reality until it went through the process.
Right.
Okay, we got as far down as Sigurdsson.
Thanks.
And it's the last paragraph in English on the page. To be continued.